This is part two of Unfound's Q&A episode number 6. If you have not yet listened to part one, please find it on your podcast application, then come back to this part two. Next question. What is your happiest memory? Well, you know, I've already answered about Star Trek and earlier about Vegas and happiest memory. But from that time, and certainly that's a big one. But what makes, you know, your happiest memory in your entire life, what makes it a little difficult to answer this question is because it's difficult because, of course, I've never been married. And, of course, any guy who would be married, whether you're straight or gay or whatever, is obligated with the potential problem of a severe penalty if you don't answer this way. Well, the day I got married, of course, or the day I met my future spouse or something along those lines. I, of course, have no story like that. In addition, parents might say, well, the day my kids were born or my son was born or my daughter was born. Well, I don't have any kids either. So it's a little more difficult for a person in my position to come up with, like, you know, happiest specific memory because I don't have anything like that. And I'm not obligated to anybody to say anything in particular, which once again, with the prospect of there being a penalty if I don't. The way I would break it down is I have a lot of happy specific memories, and most of them, I will be honest with you, have to do with me accomplishing something. Maybe going, you know, I don't want to sound like Al Bundy from Married with Children here, but I didn't play football. But going back to high school sports, I was a pretty good high school pitcher, won some pretty big games and pitched really well. Very happy memories that I can rely on there. I won because I was a great piano player at one time. I won the freshman talent show at my where I went to school, Grove City College, my freshman year. I also won the overall. In my freshman year, they had a talent show in the spring for the entire school, which was like 2,200 kids. I won that too. Yeah, like I said, I was pretty good at one time, thanks to my mother. So there's that. So winning things, winning trivia is a happy memory. I was a drag racer, won some races there. Though anything that, like I said, once again, having to keep this PG. anything having to do with winning is always going to stick out. I'm a very competitive guy. And maybe that's, you know, even when it comes to Unfound, sometimes I do feel it's me against the mystery. Me versus the mystery. Me versus the disappearance. Me versus that suspect who probably got away with murder. Me versus. And of course, you know, you at least to this point, I've lost quite a bit. But that doesn't keep me from, you know, not trying to win every week. And of course, I know all of you are part of it. We're all in this together and we're all on the same team. But that's generally how I think of it, and that's how I think about covering these disappearances. It's me against whatever happened. So winning is a big time memory. Anything having to do with that, baseball, trivia, drag racing, anything like that. And then also a very happy memory is when I got to meet my biological family for the first time in 1994. That was just this totally bizarre thing that I could not have guessed would ever happen. And, you know, going back to Star Trek, making all those friends and keeping a lot of those friends and some of those people becoming very, very special to me to this day. So a lot of that. I've had, there's no doubt that I've had a lot of success in my life, a lot of goals reached. But on the other hand, I've failed quite a bit as well. Of course, if you're going to ask me what the saddest memory is, it's, of course, my mother dying on November 28th, 2018. There's not even any competition for that. But I've failed. I can't even tell you how many things that I've tried and failed and beat myself up over that and everything. So I had a lot of great memories, but there are a lot of bad ones. Maybe my bad ones don't, you know, except for my mother dying, maybe don't. Nothing compared to what other people have experienced. Of course, a lot of people by the time they're 53 have had cancer and survived, and maybe they've lost a lot more people in their lives, way more than just their mother and everything. I get that. So a lot of fond memories, but a lot of memories, bad memories, mostly of me trying to do things and failing and everything else. So that's about, I just can't pick out one. Well, I could pick out one happiest memory, but like I said, we're keeping this PG. Next question. Ed, what do you think about there being so many kids that have gone missing lately, and some of them have been found murdered? Some of them are still missing, and it is so sad to me. I have to admit, I don't know if this is statistically true or not. This is, you have to remember, I am part of the media. I am a reporter. Yes, I know. The podcasting is the medium. That is the technology. But really, I'm a reporter. I find people to talk to. Emily finds people to talk to. Sheree finds people to talk to. People, other people out there find me people to talk to. But I'm a reporter. And I can be very, very critical of my own profession. I hate the American media. Hate it. Hate it, hate it, hate it. I think it's horrible. All of it. Politics, sports, entertainment, anything. Pretty much hate all of it. What is extended, like all of the regular stuff. You know, I'm not saying there isn't some person doing, an individual here or there doing a fine job, but just overall, I think it's certainly devolved into an environment of cynicism and sensationalism and kookism on all of it. Like I said, I'm not here to take sides in politics or sports or anything else. I think it's all horrible. So when you ask me about, well, there are the reports about kids, I don't know if that's true or not. Is it statistically true that more kids have gone missing lately? Just because it's being reported more doesn't mean that's a fact. So I can't answer that without knowing if it's factually true. And I really don't know how, if it's just recent stuff, I don't even know how I would go about comparing that to a year ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago or something like that. Or more of them are being found murdered. This person asked the question, this is that person's perception, but that doesn't make it true. And I have to be doubtful because I know just within what I know about disappearances, I know how everything gets skewed. This is my work. I don't just report on this. I study it. Been doing this for 7.5 years, and I see the work that we do here. And then I compare it to how just mainstream news. Once again, I'm not taking sides on any Fox News, CNN, MSNBC. I don't care. I see how once in a while they dabble in disappearances and how off it is. It is so off. And so then I have to also think whatever else they're reporting on, that stuff's all off too. That's how I think about things. So I don't know if that's true or not. And it's very sad anytime, no matter if it's just one kid that goes missing or is found murdered. All very sad. I just don't know if it's statistically true that within the last year, more of that is happening. And very well, unfortunately, this is the person I have to be. If it is getting reported more, are they doing that just so they can bump up their ratings? Because stories about kids going missing get attention. It's good for selling ads. So I just don't know. But I appreciate you asking the question. It's just factually, I don't think I can answer it. here in the short term. We might be able to look back in 5 years, and if we can look at Namus or the Charlie Project or whatever, well, was it true that more kids went missing and are still missing here 23 into 24? Then we'll know. I just think here in the moment, it's hard to tell. Next question. In fact, this person asked me two questions, and I'm just going to answer them in a row. First one, I'm not going to mention the person or the podcast. The person asking me the question says that this other host of a true crime podcast does not interview family members because this person wants objective facts. This person asking me, is this, in your opinion, a problem? So by interviewing family members like I do, does this give a skewed idea of what actually happened? It could. It could. It just depends how much work you want to go into preparing for an interview. I think by this time, and I get this quite a bit, that even today, to this day, where people will say, well, I was listening to the interview, and just about the time that I was thinking this question needed to be asked, you asked that exact question, Ed. That comes from experience. I would not say that, you know, you go back to the first interviews I did for Unfound, going back to 2016 with Mary Lyle and some others, other people. This is a learned skill. And so it certainly can be a problem if you're talking to somebody who is certainly could be biased, but you have to be intent on asking hard questions. And I think I do that. Certainly the interviews, we follow outlines, and we may go off on a tangent or two. And in those outlines, if you've ever seen any of them, there will be sample questions. So the guest is prepared of, well, what are we going to talk about kind of in this section? And I will put the sample questions. And once again, we don't talk about topics that the guest doesn't want to talk about. And sometimes we don't do names, and that's all usually due to the guest. But if the guest is going to say something, then I have a right to ask about it and not just clarify it. And yes, sometimes challenge it. And so you have to have the courage to do that. You have to have the courage to, even though you're trying to help the guest out and you feel for this guest and you want this disappearance solved and everything, but as a reporter, I still have to make sure that the guest just can't say anything he or she wants. And of course, that's why we don't do live interviews. As it very well could be once in a while that the guest goes off on a tangent, it's being recorded, and then I have to bring this person back kind of like to the center. Well, anything that goes way outside the boundaries that may go into, defamatory, an area that could be defamatory or complete speculation and theorizing and everything else is going to get deleted. But that doesn't happen too often. Because trust me, there are some guests that would surely love to just come on and do an interview and do nothing but criticize the police, go on and on, and go after the suspect if there is one, and surely call that person every name in the book. Surely. There are guests like that. There are. So I understand when it comes to objectivity, well, you try to handle that as best you can. I do. By just asking tough questions and then all of you deciding what you want to believe. As it comes with any interview that I've ever done, it's up to you to decide what you want to believe or not. And I've learned enough to know that most of you do not take the guest at his or her word sometimes. You think, well, maybe I think they're just seeing what they want to see. It's totally up for you to determine that. The problem, regarding, this particular other host saying, well, I don't want to interview family members because it won't be objective. Well, that's up to you. We realize that they may not be objective, but you can certainly be objective. You, the interviewer, can be objective. But to do that, you have to know the topic. You have to know disappearances. You have to understand that disappearance pretty well. You have to be able to determine what's BS and what's not. Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that every single guest that has ever appeared on Unfound has told the truth. I would be certainly naive to say that. Certainly. You just have to understand there are certain things about all these disappearances that cannot be proven. There's no way to do that. But on the other hand, there's certain things that need to be discussed. And that's why I put it all in all of your hands. I don't tell you what to think. Whatever theory you want to come up regarding regarding a disappearance is up to you. I would never think that you have to think like I do. Hopefully we're all learning here. But I certainly like to think that, I'm not trying to indoctrinate anybody. So it could be a problem, and once in a while, well, why don't you go out and try to track the suspect down? I could do that, but you don't really think I'm going to ask the suspect, well, what happened? And he's going to say, yeah, I killed her. You don't think he's really going to say that, do you? We know what for example, if we want to really get specific on this, the man said type of disappearance, these guys saying, yeah, my wife took off. You don't really think that guy's going to change his story when he talks to me, do you? Because that's what the guest says. Now, I'm not saying you have to believe it. I'm not saying you don't have to believe it. All we do is talk about, what'd he do? What'd he say? And yes, the way I do things is when I do talk to these people and I take notes, yeah, I do check into some of what they said, if I can. And if their story kind of goes along with what has been documented so far. But it's not just about when I interview these people to get the facts out. I want you all to hear what it's like for people to live with this. And it's seeming like there's no way out. They're in a nightmare in which there seems to be, I'm not saying there isn't, certainly disappearances do get solved, there seems to be no way out. All of us can go to bed at night and have a nightmare, wake up from it. These people can't. So it's not always just about facts. It's about them living with the situation. It's also about them kind of being a cautionary tale. My daughter got into this. My son got into this. This is why it happened. Hopefully that can help some of you who are raising kids, maybe to make sure your sons and daughters don't go off the rails like many of Unfound's missing people have. So it's just not about the facts. Remember, it's not unusual. You can check this. It's not unusual for us not even to get into the disappearance itself whenever it happened until like 45 minutes or an hour into the disappearance. Why? Because we spend so much time talking about the missing person. That alone should tell you it's just not about the facts. It's about getting to know that person. And maybe we can all learn from this. What have I said? Disappearances are not about circumstances. They're about people. So I dispute, that, well, objective facts, it's facts are facts. And just because somebody says something doesn't necessarily mean it's a fact. It's just the fact that that person said something. But what I would say is the interviews that I do are much more than just about the facts. And, the alternative, of course, if you don't want to talk to any family members, you want to talk to the police. And how much do you think they're going to tell you? So if you don't want to talk to them, who are you going to talk to? Well, then it devolves into what I would say, what ends up happening is too many people just start doing their podcasts. And what are they doing? They're going to Wikipedia. They're going to Web Sleuth. Well, guess what? There are a lot of mistakes on all of those sites. And what happens? The same mistakes get retread over and over and over and over. So even these people who think that, well, I don't want to talk to the family because they may be skewing things. And I can't talk to the police because they don't tell me anything. What do they end up doing? They then end up regurgitating information that's wrong. Why? Because there's no way to check those facts either sometimes. So I will pick the way I do it more than any other way there is to do it, unless you just get to the point. I suppose if we could just rationalize this ultimately all way, I guess maybe these disappearances shouldn't be covered at all. You know, if you really want to get crazy with it. In fact, I said that wasn't recently to somebody who was giving me a hard time, or I've said it more than once. Maybe you'd just be happy if we didn't cover these disappearances at all, criticizing the way I go about my business. If you don't have an alternative way to do it, you know, don't come to me with a problem if you don't have a fix. And my opinion is all the other ways to do it just don't work. There's no perfect way. If there was a perfect way, all of these disappearances would be solved by now. But they're not. There's no perfect way. There's just the best way and the right way. So the second part of it is that you brought up in an Unfound Live that a guest withheld valuable information. Do you think this happens often, sometimes seldom? I've brought it up. I don't mind talking about it publicly because I've done it before. It was the Unique Harris. Maybe this is what this person means. I covered the disappearance of Unique Harris, of course, Isaac Moy was charged not too long after that episode came out, and it turned out that Unique's mother knew some information that she did not divulge in the interview. And it very well, am I mad about that? I wouldn't say I'm mad. I'm just a little disappointed. But given that it was so close to when this guy got charged, it very well could be that she withheld some of this information because she knew the police were about to charge this guy and she just didn't want to blow it. It's very possible. I've never talked to her about it. That's the one that kind of pops up into my mind, and I'm not even sure if this is the one that I was talking about. You brought it up in an Unfound Live that a guest, I'm guessing that this is the particular disappearance. Do you think this happens often, sometimes, seldom? If you have the feeling the guest is not totally honest, do you accept this or do you deny an interview? Well, like I said before, I'm not going to allow somebody to come on to the podcast and say things that I know aren't true, first of all. On the other hand, I don't know what these people do know. All I can do is ask questions. And they're under no obligation to tell me everything. I think most of them do. I think they understand that I'm here to help. I'm putting the work in. I'm taking the time. And they feel obligated to be as transparent as possible. But I'm not going to sit here and tell you that every person has said every piece of information they know about a disappearance. That would once again be naive. Like I said before, I'm not going to get here and say that every person's told the truth. There are just certain things that are unprovable. My goal, though, is to make sure that everything makes sense and nobody's being defamed and we're all doing our best and I'm doing my best to be objective, which means having to ask some questions that may make the guest uncomfortable and not kissing the guest's butt. So do I think this, I don't know how often it happens. It doesn't worry me about if some people withhold things. But like I stated before regarding that guy that worked for the government, and that was just something. When I get worried is when I know that there's certainly information that is factual that certainly could point us all in a particular direction, and then that person doesn't want to talk about it. That is going to be a reason that a person cannot come on the podcast. So, it's not totally honest. No, I don't accept it. I don't accept it. No. Now, there may be confusion or something, and I've had a couple times where I had all my notes, we started doing the interview, and then the person starts answering the questions completely the opposite of what the person said before, and I'll stop the interview. I have to remember it was a long time ago. And I remember the disappearance. Of course, I'm not going to mention the name. But I actually had to stop the interview and say to the person, what's going on here? These things that I'm asking you, you're saying the exact opposite of what you told me before. And she admitted she was having cold feet and was worried about everything. Well, I said, well, they can't. And she finally came around. I can't do this then. But that's, like I said, it's been a while. And, but it's happened in, there's been a few times where I've taken notes, you know, an off the record conversation. And the guest said one thing, and then when I started looking it up and started looking at old news stories and doing what I can, have had to go back to the person and say, you know, you told me this, but I found this. Why is there a contradiction? Why is the conflict between what you told me and what I read this news article? Very well, maybe that the news article is wrong. Very well, maybe that they misremembered it or something. And we try to resolve that stuff before we ever do an official interview. Next question. In fact, I'm going to two questions, one from two different people. I'm going to combine it into one because they're kind of similar. Why don't more police departments have missing persons units, especially in bigger cities? First of all, I don't know how many big cities. So for all of those, what do we mean by big cities? Well, of course we mean New York, LA, I think is Houston third now? I know Chicago for a long time was third, but Chicago is certainly up there. Houston, Chicago, what would be the next biggest city after that? Maybe Miami or Dallas. Maybe we can talk, you know, St. Louis. I mean, it's obviously a major city. How many of these have missing persons units and how many don't? I think most of the big ones do. And I don't know what the line is. Is it a population or a city below a certain level, whether you get a missing persons unit or not? I don't know how it's determined. Like anything else, people cost money. Departments cost money. And it doesn't help, at least in the United States, in many of these cities, the people are moving out, whether it's due to crime, whether it's due to housing prices going up, whether it has to do with businesses moving to more hospitable environments. So we hear a lot of course, here in Florida, we hear a lot of people moving from the Northeast. People moving from New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts due to the taxes and everything else that goes on up there. Once again, not here to get into the politics of it. And so these cities get under crunches. Even the state of California, where a lot of people were moving to forever. California's population actually has gone down over the last couple of years. People moving from there. For a lot of different reasons, maybe even when I lived in Las Vegas, there were a lot of California people moving there, moving to Arizona, moving to Utah, moving to Texas. Things happen. And hey, I grew up in Pennsylvania, so I don't live where I grew up either. So these things cost money, first of all. Second of all, to do something like this, you actually have to see it as a problem. If they don't have a car theft unit, if it turns out that statistically or, you know, factually that the city's car thefts have gone up, what will they do? They'll create a task force to crack down on this. What's going on? Is there some new gang that moved into town? Or, you know, there's certain cars that they're specializing in stealing. Why is this? They will create these kind of task forces. We've also seen when it seems like there might be a serial killer, like when we had the shootings in the DC area. Yes, they had a homicide unit, but what did they do? They started like a task force, pulling in a bunch of different people from different areas to kind of look into this because it was, of course, these guys were serial killers, going around shooting from the trunk of that car. I remember that going back some years now. It was going on, I think, while I was at Star Trek. It's been like 20 years now, but it seems like yesterday. And so they can do this, but to have something that is constant, that actually has its own offices with missing persons department on the door or wing of the building or whatever, you actually have to see this as a problem. You actually have, and on top of that, if you're going to create something like that, then there has to be, you should be, some education that goes along with it. You just don't throw a bunch of people in there and you're going to do this. But that's what's done. We do have missing persons units in New York City, LA, and these other big cities. I don't know if these people working these cases know any more than any of you do. No offense. But they're the ones, their jobs, they're supposed to know. I realize you listen to this podcast. I'm trying to educate you. I'm educating myself. But I happen to think that many of you would do fine jobs, more serious jobs than if you were in these missing persons units. But I'm reminded, I know this is a funny place to go with this, but there was a Law and Order. Was it Law and Order, the regular one, like the original one, the one I know it's come back out again, but the one that was like between 1990 and 2014 or whenever it was. Was it that one? I think it was the Prime, what they call Law and Order Prime, the first one, in which the homicide detectives had to deal with like a missing persons unit or detective, and they portrayed it as some little department that's down in the basement and somebody's just like kicked back in a chair with the feet up on the desk. And I got to tell you, I don't know how much difference that is from the truth. I think that the missing persons unit, there, for example, there's a reason that you hear so many of the guests talk about how, well, you know, our disappearance is only 8 years old and we've had five different detectives. There are reasons. And this would be the situation even in – now, grant, a lot of that is with departments that don't have specific, concentrated, dedicated missing persons units. But even in New York City, you know, we've covered some disappearances there, Chelsea Cobo, et cetera. We've covered some disappearances in L.A. We've covered some disappearances in some big cities. Same thing. It's like a carousel of different – detectives and investigators over the years. Nobody wants to be part of that. If you want to be an investigator, if you want to go the investigation route in a department, in contrast to like the manager route, where you actually then become head of chief of police or whatever, the lowest rung on, you can be on is the missing persons unit. Nobody aspires to be in the missing persons unit. You have to remember that. So why don't more police departments have missing persons units? It takes money. You have to see it as a problem. And it actually maybe has to be a job that somebody actually wants to do. And those are all issues. So I think that's the reason. Now, of course, I'm going to excuse these small police departments, of course. I mean, the little town that I grew up, Leechburg, Pennsylvania, are there any unsolved disappearances there right now? I don't think so. They have like two cops. Vandergrift, which is like kind of next door, which is a bigger town. What do they have? Three or four cops. I mean, what do you expect them to, what do you expect them to do? So I realized that I have to temper my expectations regarding this. I just don't know how many big cities have them and how many don't. Either way, even if they do, I'm not sure what kind of impact they're having. You know, we could look at Chelsea Cobo's disappearance. There's a lot of facts with her disappearance, a lot of people, a lot of names. We have these locations. We have phone calls. We know her mother's very, very motivated to try to figure out what happened to Chelsea. She's still missing, and New York Police Department's the largest police department in the United States. So even just having a missing persons unit may not matter. It takes more than that. So the second part of the question, or not second part, but somebody else asked me a question that was kind of similar. If you were in charge of a missing persons unit at a police station, what changes would you make to finding a missing person more successful? First of all, my biggest thing would be to add some pride to it. Biggest thing what I would do is make sure it's not seen as being like the lowest of all these special investigation departments. Number one, you have to take pride in your work. You want people, what is coach of the, you know, Mike Tomlin, coach of the Steelers. Now I think the longest tenured coach in the NFL, and being that Bill Belichick has retired for the time being from the Patriots. What does Mike Tomlin say about the players that play for him? He wants volunteers, not hostages. He wants players who want to be Pittsburgh Steelers. He doesn't want people there who don't want to be there. This is my attitude that I would bring to a missing persons unit. First and foremost, we have to get some pride here. We have to be excited about our work no matter what happens. Remember, doctors who work on cancer, they see a lot of death. They don't move over necessarily to doing plastic surgery. They stick with it. This is the attitude you have to have. This isn't just something so you can move on to some other post that you see as being more important. If you're going to be here, you're going to be an all-star. That's what you're going to do. And we're going to be happy about our work, and we're going to take pride in it. We're going to be happy to be doing what we're doing. That to me is more important than you know, bringing more money into it or whatever else. Being motivated to do something can overcome a lot of hurdles that money can't. So that's a change. I'm sure that would be a change. That's not the feeling that I get. I don't know how much that's going on of that. So I think me coming in and having that attitude, I think would be a huge change. No increase in pay or anything, but if you're in this unit, we're going to find a way to be happy being here, to the point that maybe you're not going to be so motivated to get the heck out and do some, you know, and go over to a different unit, vice or car theft, robbery, bank robbery, or homicide, or whatever else. That alone, I think, would bring a lot more success. Then, going along with that, what can bring a lot of pride and confidence to people? Educating them. You know, get them to become experts, to know what they're talking about. I continue to believe that people do want to know things, and they love to know a lot and be able to put it to use. Give those people those tools. So that would be a couple changes. And these are surely two things that are not being done. Next question. I think I've answered this question more than once, but it comes up. You just would not know. Over the course of a year, granted, I do this Q&A once a year. Like I said, it's amazing. This is number six. I just thought it was like number three or four. I said that before. Comes up at least once a month over the course of a year. Why are you single? Ed, are you single? La, 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 yada, 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 yada. And I think this is the reason it comes up is because I do talk about being single and because the audience is 80, as with any podcast or YouTube channel or TV show or whatever, the audience is 80% women. Why are you single? Well, first of all, you should know something. This is new. Is that I was told by a very trusted person. I would call this person a friend of the podcast. You know how I refer to certain people who help with the podcast. They aren't volunteers or assistants, but they've either appeared on the podcast or, you know, like Dr. Grace Telesco. This is not who mentioned this, but somebody like that. I just refer to them as friends of the podcast. And this person told me just within the last couple months that this person knows some other people within the true crime community, and my name came up, and there was this talk about whether, am I gay? The answer is no. Not, and to do the whole Seinfeld thing, not that there's anything wrong with that. But that was actually a conversation, I guess, some other people, within the true crime community were having about me, and this got back to me, and I have no reason to believe that this was be a lie. This would not surprise me at all. But the issue is that even though I'm a very public person when it comes to the podcast, doing the live show, going in and talking to people, and I have no problems with, I don't want any, what is it, agoraphobia? I do not have an agoraphobia at all. I can go up, talk in front of people. Doesn't necessarily have to be about disappearances. You want me to get up there and talk about disc golf? I can do that. You want me to get up there and talk about movies from the 1980s? I can do that. And there's really no fear or anything. Certainly, I go to trivia every week. There's usually 100 some people there. I do not have agoraphobia, but I need a lot of space. I need a lot of space. I've had roommates, had a great roommate. Her name was Crystal for 2 years. She was more like a sister to me. We were not romantically linked. In fact, she met her future husband while we were roommates in Las Vegas. I lived with two other women before I left Las Vegas. Once again, just friends. No romantics going on there. Just worked out financially for both of us. But when it comes to my romantic life and everything, I need a lot of space. And I like living by myself. And I think one of the main keys is that I don't get lonely. And at 53, I think I've had enough living behind me to know that a reason a lot of people get married, and I would say this is a bad reason, or get into relationships, and I would say it's a bad reason, is because they are lonely. I think that is a very, very, very bad reason to be in a relationship. But a lot of people do that. Well, I don't get lonely, so I'm not motivated to do that. I've always been a little bit of a loner, even going back to high school. Many great friends and everything. But I had no problems back in the day just cruising around by myself, going to different hangout spots, showing up, talking for a while with whoever was there, and then jumping in my car and going to another spot, being in Leechburg, going to Lower Borough, going to, Vandergrift, going over to like the Greensburg area just by myself because I had friends in all of these areas. And a lot of times I did that by myself. And then also, I don't know if it's affected me, but I was raised an only child. So once again, I had a lot of space. I never had to share anything, share possessions, or share love between my parents and any other kids. Remember, my biological siblings were actually raised by the biological parents. I was not. So I think that that's a huge factor in me being single at 53. And I think maybe why this has come up. Is he straight? What is he? Is it, because I guess maybe I do have a lot of redeeming qualities. And certainly I have had girlfriends. And certainly I've had some experience that I can't talk about here and everything else. But the reason I'm single is because I just need a lot of space. In addition, I will also tell you that I just don't run into a lot of women who I'm attracted to. That seemed to happen a lot more when I lived in Las Vegas. Of course, of being involved in entertainment helps. And that helps. But that's not the situation I have here in Florida. But just the way it goes sometimes. Although I think this move to Florida has in many ways been positive, there are things about Las Vegas that I do miss, and I do love that city, even though certainly changed since I've been there, and they're running out of water and everything else. But the other issue, though, is when it comes to my taste in women, I like women who are like myself, who also like space. That, and so you can understand, and certainly there are people like myself who like a different type. Maybe they do like, you know, people who don't like space or something. My tastes go toward women who are like myself, who are not motivated to live together, who are okay with just seeing each other like a couple times a week and doing this and doing that and maybe going on a, you know, vacation once in a while, going on a trip. And that's the only type of situation that's interesting to me. But also on top of that, I have very high standards when it comes to all the other stuff as well. As far as looks and intelligence, I have very high standards simply because that's what I'm used to. And trying to find any women like that is tough. And it doesn't bother me. I'm perfectly fine in this situation. I'm not complaining at all. At all. Perfectly fine with it. But that's the reason. Is that I'm a particular type of guy. And the type of women that I'm interested are rare. They exist. Certainly, some of my ex-girlfriends are those types, and there's reasons that it didn't work out. But maybe the reason it didn't work out is because we are who we are. That we need our space. We don't want to have to talk to that person every day. We won't have to feel obligated to say, well, how was your day? And if you don't, there's going to be repercussions. I don't want to be in a relationship like that. There's nobody in my life who ever has to ever ask me, how was your day? All right. Whereas to a lot of people, that's important. It's not important to me. So there's nobody, as I have said many times, there's nobody that I'd want to see or talk to every day. Now, I talk to my dad every day simply because we're separated by 1,000 miles. All right, and he's 87 years old, and I don't know how many days he has left on this earth. Other than that, though, even though my brother lives 20 minutes away, we certainly do not talk every day. You know, so, you know, how many women are really interested in that type of situation? Probably not too many. They're certainly out there, but they're rare. They're very independent women. They're usually women who are running their own businesses. They're professional types, and that's great. Fantastic. Love it. Love it. But, you know, the overall package is rare, and I'm not one for compromise. So my taste in women is very much like who I am, and I'm very unique. I mean, how many guys do you know at 53 who have never been married, don't have any kids, are heterosexual, and actually don't have a criminal record and don't have any mental health issues and all those other things? I, by myself, am a very, 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 very rare cat. Very rare. Given all of that put together. And actually, on top of that, I think it has some redeeming qualities that I'm take care of myself, I'm funny, I'm sociable, and everything else. It's very rare. Likewise, the women that I'm interested in are very rare too. So that's on top of everything. That's why I'm single. So hard to have a serious relationship, I've written here. Hard to have a serious relationship with people who are so dang independent. So once again, I answered that question. I think I answered it a different way. And probably next year I'll answer it a different way, but it'll still be the truth. This is all the truth. Next question, I make it a point to, even if I don't get this question, I make it a point to say it anyway. And that is what got me into this. As I've said many times before, but I know there are many of you who are new to the podcast. How I got into this, I've always been interested in disappearances. Since I was a little kid, there was the show In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy. Opened my eyes, mind. As like a 6 or 7 year old, oh my gosh, there's this world out there where the UFOs and Amelia Earhart and vampires and the Nazca lines or whatever they're called, et cetera. Man, what is going on out there? Me and this, you know, this house out there in Gilpin Township in Pennsylvania, and all of this being brought to the screen back in the 1970s. I was like, wow, this is incredible. Now, of course, I look back at it now as well, as they were certainly spinning some yarns on that show, and that show certainly was cheesy and everything else, but to a seven-year-old, it was just like the most fascinating thing ever. And I think that's kind of what got my mind going. And then there was Cops, even though I never wanted to be a police officer, but there was the Cops that started in, what, in the 90s, Bad Boys, What You Gonna Do? And then also my friends, the Kara Stories, they were all brothers, three of them. Their father was a part-time cop, so they had a scanner in their house, which always fascinated me. You know, listening to what's going on out there. You can listen, you can hear the cops from different jurisdictions and what they're doing, where they're going. And then the internet came along. And I remember the first disappearance I ever looked up on the internet was Jody Huzentrout, which conveniently, unfortunately, very sadly, started around the same time her disappearance happened, right around the time we got the internet in Leechburg, PA, around 1995. And already I was discovering that my mind goes very well with accumulating facts and organizing them. I'd already had this interest in plane crashes by that point. And anytime there would be a plane crash, of course, back then with commercial airliners, they were crashing a lot more than they do now. And so I'd tune in and just watch over and over and over and over and over. The coverage of plane crashes, and that was like, I guess CNN was the only 24/7 news source at that time. The other ones came in a little bit later, but even CBS or whatever, they might devote a lot of time to a plane crash. I got interested in that because I had a fear of flying. And then I got some speaking experience and a lot of writing experience and improv comedy experience and acting experience and filmmaking experience and all that. And then finally, all of that, the technology caught up with all of my interests, all of that other stuff, podcasting, and that's how Unfound came together. Of course, I was involved in another true crime podcast before this one that didn't work out, where I hosted the show with another person. And even then, I was thinking, you know what? As Jack Black, what was his Ned? Dewey Finn, although he went by Ned Schneebly in the movie School of Rock. What does he say in that one scene? He goes, "I got vision up the butt, so get out, stay out of the way. Don't pull a power play on me. I got vision up the butt." I figured that's kind of the way I'm in. Once again, why it didn't work out as an independent filmmaker. I have a certain thing that I want to do, and that's it. So that's how it all came together. It was genetically, my mind, environmentally, everything that was subjected to me that I ran into over the course of my life from a seven-year-old, and then the technology of podcasting. That is how it all came together, and every part of it was needed. That's how I got into this. Almost done. But I left these ones where I needed some notes until the end. And one is about a disappearance that has not been covered by Unfound yet. The next question is then about people getting involved. And then the third one is going to be about Brian Schaefer. These are all asked by the same person. But at least on the first part, I needed to do a little research because I know this disappearance, but to answer the question, I had to actually look into it. So the question was, I believe you say if you watched the series Never Seen Again, I found the most intriguing case to be that of Kelly Brannon, who disappeared from a motel in rural Florida, yeah, in Live Oak, where she was living with her boyfriend. And so the question is, how would you counsel law enforcement to approach this investigation? In other words, I'm asking what you believe an effective investigation would look like, given the facts already known about the case. So this is what I'm going to try to do, but I don't want to get into all the nooks and crannies of this disappearance, because if I get into all of them, I'm sure you're going to forget a lot of them anyway. But for the record, I don't know what the police have done. I've never spoken to anybody in her family about her disappearance. It just happens to coincidentally have taken place here in Florida. So other than what is public, I don't know any. I know all of what you know. All right, so just keep that in mind. What I would say is that there are certain things that I want to pick out. Once again, I'm not getting your, all of you are just going to have to look up this disappearance for yourselves, because I just, if I go through all of it, you're not going to remember most of it anyway. But if the following is true, what I've read about the facts for it, this, regarding going, for example, to the Charlie Project, and then I think that I have watched this episode of Never Seen Again, but it's been months and months ago. So what I would say in general is you got to follow up on anything a person of interest has said. Now, this is a the man said type of disappearance. I'll give you that. So anytime you have a the man said, where the guy is saying, well, the woman took off, she got in a truck with somebody, she did this, she did that, you as an investigator have to follow up on all of it. And of course, what you're looking, of course, for is the guy lying or not. My perception is this isn't done enough. My perception is too often investigators, the first police officer on the scene, just kind of believes whatever the guy says. Now, it very well may be that eventually that attitude changes. That eventually, unfortunately not a couple days down the road, but a month down the road or something, it may change. And then that police officer, that investigator starts thinking, you know what, I think this guy lied to me. Whereas what I would say is that when you show up to something like this, you have to, you know, unfortunately, I know, remember, here at Unfound, we're not in the law business. We're in the information business. And I realize here in the United States, we have the idea of a person is innocent until proven guilty. Well, I will tell you that when you're an investigator and you're showing up like something with the disappearance of Kelly Brannon, B-R-A-N-N-O-N, it's best just to show up thinking, as soon as the guy starts talking and saying, well, she took off and I don't know what happened to her, it's best just to think that he's lying. And you're going to check every single thing that that guy says. And so with that as our starting point regarding this type of disappearance, here are some things that I see just reading about her disappearance. Is that it says here that they plan to buy a house in Detroit and live there. Is that true? If this is something this guy told investigators, yeah, we were heading from Florida to Detroit, and they were going to be buying a house somewhere. Well, what's the address of that house? Is there any proof that they had any interactions with a homeowner or a real estate agent there? And that's very easy to figure out. If the guy says so, you just ask him, well, what's the name of the realtor? What's the address? I'd like to check into that. Now, if he doesn't want to show you, then that's a huge red flag, of course. Next thing is the story goes is that they were headed there, and the guy involved in Kelly's life, his truck broke down. So they're in different vehicles, and they're both going from Florida to Michigan, and his truck broke down on allegedly July 9th of 2020. And they were staying in the hotel while they waited for the vehicle to get repaired. Is that true? Well, where is the truck? Where was it getting worked on? It broke down on July 9th. Why wasn't it fixed by July 14th or 15th? What exactly was wrong with it? Did the transmission go? Did the engine blow up? Did it spring a leak? Was it leaking coolant? What exactly was the problem? And does it sound reasonable that it would take 5 or 6 days to get fixed? Now, my dad was in a wreck a month ago. He still hasn't gotten his vehicle back. Not a bad one. He's fine. I'm not even sure it was his fault. But once again, if this guy's going to say my truck got broken down, whoa, is that true? Got to check it out. So the next part of it, after an argument, Brannon, the missing woman, left the hotel room but continued contact with Emerson with text messages. Can this guy Emerson show police these text messages? And does it seem, and if you, being that you have his phone, you don't have her phone, he certainly has other texts from her from the past. Does it look like she, is the language consistent? The prior text messages, let's say from 2 months ago, do those look like the ones that were sent the night of the disappearance? You could look into that. Emerson says he took her car keys away from her so she wouldn't drive under the influence. So he says that she was drunk. Does he have her keys? That's what he says he did, but does he have her keys? Where is her car? Can we look at it? Can we do forensics on it? Because if his vehicle was getting worked on, and if there was foul play, then I guess he must have used her vehicle to get rid of her. So, you know, can we look at that vehicle? You have the keys. Thanks. We're going to look in it and see who's a missing person. They would have every right to do that. They would not need a warrant to do that. Next, once again, according to the published reports, it says shortly before 1 a.m., Brannon left a voicemail for Emerson saying she had gotten another room at the hotel for herself and was threatening to leave him and go to Detroit by herself or go to Iceland. I'm not making this up. So if this was a voicemail, was Emerson able to play this voicemail for investigators? And some of you maybe know this disappearance very well. Maybe you know some of these answers already. But this is what should have been done. I don't know if it was done or not. Could he play that message saying that she said that? In addition, you could easily go, police could easily go to the office and say, hey, there's this woman. Did she really get a room for herself? What if the answer is no? In addition, she said she was threatening to go to Iceland. Well, she was drunk. Maybe she could make that up. Did she have a passport to go to Iceland? And of course, already at this point, you're saying, well, you know, she's threatening to leave him to go by herself. And then it says suddenly she announced she was getting in a car, and that was when the messages ended. So in addition, some other things that could, of course, she was never seen again. Her purse, money, identification, and other belongings were left behind at the hotel inside her unlocked car. Why would she do that? But her phone and a guitar were missing, and it's a very unique guitar in that it's a left-handed guitar. So even though those are rare already, Fender Stratocaster with a sunburst finish and branding is sanded off the headstock, so it's unique. Unique. Very unique left-handed guitar with the Fender, I guess, logo taken off of it for some reason. And I guess it's still missing. Did you check any pawn shops? And in the area, how many pawn shops could there be around Live Oak, Florida? And because certainly guitars are something that are often pawned, especially a left-handed one would be unique. In addition, maybe get on eBay or Facebook store, whatever they're calling it. Anybody selling something like that? These are all things that you can do to figure out if this guy is telling the truth or not. So those are some of the things that just come to mind. And if all of that checks out, and it sounds like this guy is telling the truth, that yes, they were talking to a realtor. And yes, his truck was broken. And yes, you go into the car and there are no signs of violence. And you don't find and you do find that she really did register for another room. On and on and on. Then I guess we have to start thinking that this guy really didn't have anything to do with this. And that she really did walk off. And being that she was drunk, I think that raises the possibility that is what she did. But certainly, if this guy Emerson is going to offer up all of this information, then you as an investigator, you are obligated to check every single thing. So that's my answer to that part of it. Without knowing those answers, I don't know what to think of it. Very well could be that she walked off with her guitar and something happened. I doubt she got in a car with somebody, though. I doubt it. Either Emerson did something to her, or she was drunk and walked off and died in the woods around there or something. Those are really the only two options, though. All right, next question. Is there any case or two Unfound has covered that you believe that that is close to being solved if only some motivated and thoughtful member of the public or group would devote the time to running down publicly available leads? What I'm asking is if any cases come to mind that are ripe for being solved if a dedicated group were to come in and do some serious legwork. This is inspired by the Paul Sanders podcast that some Unfounders are working on. Yeah, that's going on. Really hate picking out any. So I'm going to try not to do that, but I'm going to do it anyway. It's kind of going to try to walk a fine line here. What I would say is any of the disappearances where there is ample reason to believe the people walked off, ran off, and there's no foul play. Just some examples, even though there are many choices. David Hardy Jr., David Schrader, Renee LaManna, and there are many, many more. Any of these in which the odds of being a foul play are very, 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 very low. And it's also the odds are very, 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 very low that this person got in a car and took off with somebody. The person got picked up randomly. Because what we're left with is this person walked off and has to be somewhere in the area. Of course, with David Hardy Jr. having dementia or Alzheimer's, his car is abandoned. He's somewhere in that area. You know me with searches. Just search a mile in any direction and you just keep doing that. David Schrader, same thing. Renee LaManna, I mean, she was out essentially on an island. Where could she go? Maybe she went into the water. That would certainly make searching for her difficult, especially since it was 30 years ago. But any of these where it's reasonable, it's ample reason to believe that the person ran off, walk off, there was no foul play. All of those. Because it's just a matter of getting a group together, going out there and searching again, even though some of these disappearances are fairly old. So as for ones where there are actually foul play situations, where there's a good reason to believe it was foul play, I think our experience teaches us that any of the man-said disappearances. And what do I mean by experience? Well, of course, with Andrea Bowman, her father, of course, said that she ran off. Of course, she didn't. Carlos Rodriguez said that Zoe Campos drove away from her house. Of course, we know that she didn't. So then it could lead us to believe that any of the man-said type of disappearances are certainly ripe as well from history. But also what goes into that is most of these guys are not career criminals. And I'm not going to pick out any names or any disappearances. Some of you should know what some of these that I pick out. I don't really want to go there picking any out. But any of these where they're the man-said type of disappearances and the man, are not career criminals. These are the guys who are most likely to crack. These are the guys who are most likely to make mistakes. These are the guys who are most likely to eventually display some sort of conscience. These are the ones that I think are very ripe for being solved. Because you have a pretty, pretty good idea what happened anyway. It's just sitting down and figuring out, how are we going to do this? In contrast to maybe, I'll just pick one out, like a Jason Jolkowski, where anything's possible. So what also helps is that being that these guys do not have criminal records, a lot of them, either before the disappearance or after the disappearance, these men, to this day, I mean, they go to the store, and for the record, nobody should go out and harass these guys. Do not do that. Do not stalk them. Do not try to cut them off in public. Do not go to their house and stand on public property, but you have a bullhorn. screaming at their house. Don't do any of that. Don't do that. All right. I know some of you, I suppose you may legally be able to get away with standing on private property and shouting at the house or something like that, at least for a little while. Don't do that. But these guys are continuing to live their lives. They're out in public. They probably have groups that they're involved in. They go shopping, or they go to church or whatever else. This gives ample opportunity for people who are so motivated to get to know these guys. And maybe, just maybe, you can work within their defenses somehow, one way or another, where they do start talking about their wives and girlfriends who went missing. And of course, I'm never going to expect they're just going to come out and say what happened and whether they're guilty or not. But you never know what's going to come out of their mouths. But it maybe is time. You know, I try to put myself in the position. What if one of my friends was in a position? What if one of my friends who was married, his wife went missing? I'll just pick somebody out to make it easier. My friend Doug, who lives in North Carolina, who I've known since elementary school. He's one of my best friends, spectacular guy. What if his wife went missing? And what if he was saying, the man said type of example? We went to bed, I woke up the next day, and her car was here, her clothes were here, her phones were here, la 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 la, but she's missing. And I've never been to Doug's house, but I know where he lives, and it's in a neighborhood, not a suburb, but there are houses next door, and I think maybe has a little bit of woods in the back and everything else. How would I feel about that? Of course, it'd be a very unique situation given that I do disappearances for work. But I think that I would be inclined to inquire about the situation and have a talk with him and everything. And I just wonder, these guys have friends. What are these friends doing? What do these friends who have known these men for years and years and years say about these guys? And what do they think? Is there anything that we need to know about this guy? What makes them tick? Certainly my friends who have known me for 40 years, like Doug has known me, certainly I think in some ways knows what makes me tick. Like I know like what Doug and all my friends, just from being around them. And, we've known each other long enough. We know where the hot buttons are and everything else. Well, this is kind of what I'm thinking. We're allowed to do that in the United States. Don't harass them. Don't stalk them. Don't confront them in a supermarket, pointing fingers at them and yelling and everything else. Don't do any of that. You do any of that, I'm not going to support it. I do not support any of that. What I do support is rational, calm, thoughtful questioning. And getting to know that person, being around that person, if you can do that, and finding anybody who has any interaction with that guy and seeing, and it very well may be, you can never dismiss anything. It very well may be some people who really know these guys well don't even know the guy's wife's missing. There's no law in the United States against telling his friends, did you know that John Smith's wife is missing? And do you know the circumstances? Because it very well may be his friends think, he just told us she left them. They may just believe that. And they just want to believe that. Well, you may just have to enlighten them. But I think that the man said types, like I said, are ripe for that. This kind of getting very up close and personal, I guess you might say, with a suspect, with the people around the suspect. Don't bother going to family. That's not going to work. Coworkers may work. Friends and groups, like maybe, for me, maybe it would be my disc golf friends here in Florida, as an example. You know, for my brother Brian, it might be the guy, the people that he works with for the part-time job that he has. For my brother's wife, Laureen, it might be, you know, if she's not causing my brother Brian's disappearance, it might be the people that in the school district that she used to work in that got to know her better. All of this, I think this is something to, you know, something novel to do that I don't think is being done too much out there. So I don't want to pick out any particular cases. I'll just pick out what I think is a particular type that is more likely to be solved than other types. For example, on the other hand, surely something bad happened to Patty Action, who disappeared in Clearwater back in 1979. How do we know? The car had all of her blood in it. But good luck. I'm not saying it can't be solved, but that was 40-some years ago, and that seems to me to be a lot more difficult because it very well could have been something random. Whereas we know these man-said ones are not random with 99% certainty. So you pick the ones where you pretty much think you know what happened, and then you try to work your way around the legalities and of trying to figure out what happened and not invading anybody's rights. I think that's better off than picking one that's really, really, totally, totally up in the air and then trying to figure out where to go, my opinion. All right, so finally, it's a Brian Schaefer question. And the question is, how is it that despite all the Brian Schaefer podcasts and other coverage that existed prior to Unfound's episode, including some very thorough ones in which Kelly Bruce and other knowledgeable people were involved, your podcast was the first that got into a detailed discussion of the acquaintances of Schaefer who were at the Ugly Tuna during his second visit? And this does not include the man and woman that have Clinton and Alexis. What this questioner, the person asking, is these other people who were there who also happened to know Brian. In fact, despite a ton of research that I'd done prior to hearing your episode, I'd never heard a word about these mysterious acquaintances before. Is this an incredible oversight, or is there some other reason that this group has gotten basically zero attention other than in your episode? Well, what I did was I just went right to the source, and I specifically asked Kelly Bruce, always mess up her married last name, Kochnauer. So I apologize, Keller, if you're listening. So here was what Kelly said back to me. So I actually did, she says, did discuss the other people that were at the bar that night on the Brian Schaefer Dead or Alive show, podcast, but it was minimal since I was just finding everything out. Once I began getting in more information is when I was approached by a company to go under contract, and part of the contract stated that I couldn't cover the case until the episode aired. I gave that company the information during my interview, but they chose not to use it. After the interview, I began talking about it on the group page I run for Brian in detail. Right around that time is when you decided to cover Brian's case. As far as no one else talking about it, I was told by Columbus Police Department the group had been was seen leaving before Brian, so they were ruled out. So that's the reason. So it's a combination of Kelly was not, she had known about it for a while, but she wasn't allowed to talk about it because of the contract she had with a particular company. But then that show came out on that company, and so then she was allowed to talk about it. It was just timing. She was allowed to talk about it with me. But then I guess a secondary factor is that, at least according to Columbus Police Department, is that these people were cleared. So it very well may be everybody else who talked about it either didn't know about it because Kelly was the only one who knew about it, or they did know about it. And since Columbus Police Department had cleared them, They just didn't feel like these other people were worth mentioning. That's the best. That's not from me. That's from Kelly. And I don't know what else to say about it. I don't think there's any conspiracy here. I don't think that it's certainly nothing that was made up or anything. I don't know what to make. I don't really, I've already stated what I think happened to Brian Schaefer, but I'm not going to talk about it here. It's an interesting piece of information. I mean, what are the odds that he would show up at some ugly tuna and these other people would be there? But it seems like a popular hangout for people who were going to Ohio State University. So, and it doesn't sound to me like they were laboring to keep their names out of the news, or they had threatened anybody. Well, we don't want to be included in any Brian Schaefer's coverage or anything like that. That's just the way the timing, I guess, worked out. I would also say, and you should know, I know this person who asked this question very, very well. He is in the think tank. We've had a lot of back and forth through email. But I would also say is that you also have to remember that a lot of this Brian Schaefer coverage is just regurgitation. There's nobody out there really actually doing any work finding new information. They're just, because Brian Schaefer's disappearance is gotten popular for whatever reason, they see, well, we can get a lot of views by doing this. That's what they do. And they just go rip off other people. If other people haven't talked about it, then they're not going to talk about it either. Whereas we know with Kelly, she's doing original work. So it stands to reason that she would have information that nobody else would have. And then on top of that, she was just not allowed to say something for quite a while. And it just so happened that she appeared on Unfound when she was allowed to start talking about some of this information that she couldn't mention until that point. So I hope that answers that question. Final question for this Q&A episode number 6. How do you think people can support the missing if a missing person's family members that were in the initial point of contact are deceased? An example would be Tyler Stice, of course, his sister Jessica, very sadly committed suicide in the fall of, I think it was 2017. She was the first Unfound guest to die, and unfortunately we've had quite a few since then. Very, very sad. What it's going to take is people wanting to get involved. I don't know what else to tell you. I think Jessica was an excellent voice for Tyler's disappearance. But Jessica had a lot going on besides Tyler's disappearance. She had lost a child to a drowning, and she had then become an advocate for teaching kids how to swim so they wouldn't drown. And then somewhere within all of that, the pressure and stress and everything got to her, and she committed suicide somehow. And you should know, I had a messenger talk with her 2 days before she killed herself. And in fact, I don't know if it's still up, but there were pictures of her at some football game or something, just seeming having a great time and everything, like on that preceding Friday, and by Tuesday she was dead. It's going to take people getting involved. If you're waiting for somebody else to do it, then you're probably going to be waiting a long time. And I know that if you're not a family member, for just using Tyler Stice as an example, it's interesting that that one was picked out, given that there's been some controversy with Unfound's coverage and me not allowing a certain other YouTube channel to use the interview and everything, and the answer is always going to be no, and that's not changing. But you got to find a way to do it. It's easy to find reasons not to. It's easy to say, well, they're not going to do this, and I don't have time to do that. And it's very easy to do all that. It's always going to be easy to do nothing. So that's really all I can say about it. But you just can't, the way I think about it is you just can't barge in and say, well, she's dead. I want to help out. There's going, and I really at this point wouldn't even know who to talk to in Tyler's family. Of course, you should know. Jessica thought that, was it the stepfather or father could have something to do with Tyler's disappearance, and that her mother or stepmother might be covering it up. Something, that's something that Jessica thought. I'm not saying I believe that. I'm just telling you, I know that that was something that, a theory that Jessica really bought into. All right. I'm not saying I buy into it. I'm telling you she bought into it. So it could make it tough to get involved if you want to go along with Jessica's thinking. Then it's going to be a little dicey. You know, if you wanted to go talk to them, they're going to tell you the truth. I don't know. So in this particular situation with Tyler Stice's disappearance in particular, it could be a little more difficult maybe than some others. But if you're going to use that one as an example, that's going to be tough. There are other ones that there are probably other still other people to talk to, other family members who might be involved. But that's not a unique situation, though, with Jessica. I mean, she may be the only family member that gives a dang. It's very common. A lot of the guests who appear on Unfound, they are the only ones in their families who are doing anything. And the rest of the families, family members, don't give a dang. Very common. But the way you go about it is you just inquire whatever John Smith went missing. You find, track the family down somehow. What I would suggest is you just stick to a disappearance in your area. Somewhere where you can actually maybe go meet somebody in person and look that person in the eye, because then that family member has a lot of trust in you. And you have to take it slow. If you think that you're just going to show up and they're just going to tell you everything that you need to know, it's probably not going to happen. You need to build trust. You need to follow through with what you say you're going to do. That's the way I do it with my, I think we talk about during the, when we had the assistants as interviews, I talked about, you know, I try to give them some things to do and see if they follow through. Can you do this for me? Can you do that for me? Can you do this for me? I'd like you to, can you look into this? And they show that they can do those things and follow through on their word and do the job pretty decently. Excellent. You need to do the same. Whatever you say that you want to do, you have to follow through with it, but you have to take it slow. You know, and you can't get frustrated. In fact, I would say to any families out there, be suspicious of anybody who says they want to get involved, and the first time you talk to that person, they want to know everything. Be suspicious of those people. The person who is in it for the long haul understands you need to take this slow. You're strangers. There's trust issues. A lot of these families have been scammed before. They've been mistreated. I certainly know from the work that I do that they've been interviewed by other people and those interviews didn't go very well, on and on and on. These are very, very scarred people. Have to take it slow. And you have to be in it for the long haul. Not just for the next month, but maybe for the next 10 years. And if you're not willing to put that kind of, commitment to it, then I would just stay out of it. That's my advice. And that's the program. Right now, while you are in your podcast platform, Spotify, YouTube, iTunes, wherever, give Unfound a 5-star review, a thumbs up, whatever that platform allows. I thank you for listening. I'm Ed Densel, and you've just finished this episode of Unfound.